from other people, that's a crime to knowingly and willfully misreport the sources of your funds, as well as to lie to the federal government.
Now, Santos has said in interviews that he broke no laws. He says this was his own money he loaned to his campaign. But his financial history now faces close scrutiny, and Democrats are calling on the Federal Election Commission to also investigate.
So lying about the money would be the crime, but there are other lies to get our brains around here, Brian, one of which he says is not a lie. He says, well, he just didn't speak all that clearly about his religion.
Yeah, this piece is sparking a lot of outrage. The Republican Jewish Coalition now says Santos directly misled them about his heritage. They say Santos is no longer welcome at any of their functions. Some Republican leaders are acknowledging this is pretty explosive. The head of the Nassau County Republican Committee, a guy named Joseph Cairo Jr., released a statement saying, and I'm quoting here, Steve, the damage that Santos's lies have caused to many people, especially those who've been impacted by the Holocaust, are profound. In interviews, Santos now says he always described himself as Jew-ish. That's his phrase, sort of, I guess, a claim to be sort of Jewish. But that explanation is not going over well.
What are other Republican-ish leaders saying about this scandal?
Well, they're mostly silent at this point. Some have called for an investigation by the House Ethics Committee, but none are saying that Santos shouldn't be sworn in. Santos, when on Long Island, remember, helped Republicans capture a narrow majority in the House, and Congressman Kevin McCarthy had praised Santos's victory, but now he's mostly gone silent. It's worth noting here that Santos promised to back McCarthy for House Speaker. McCarthy's still scrambling to round up enough GOP support to win that post. So despite this controversy, Santos could wind up being a really key vote next week, helping decide the House leadership.
He could be a decisive vote. Brian, thanks.
Thank you.
NPR's Brian Mann. People around Buffalo, New York, say they've made it through the blizzard of recent days by relying on each other. They have even relied on each other's body heat. Annabelle Padilla has two roommates and a cat.
Things in our house, oils, our soap, everything was frozen. Most of our water was frozen. You know, nothing was working. So we all had to sleep in one bed, every single blanket in the house, trying to keep the cat warm, ourselves warm.
Padilla found a Facebook group called Blizzard in Buffalo and asked for help.
And in the matter of almost 5 minutes, I had almost 5-10 people commenting on it, trying to get us out of our house. And fortunately, this woman named Jennifer connected me with another woman named Meg that was our neighbor down the street, and she had an open apartment, and she let us go in and take refuge in her house.
Padilla's mom is Bridget Thornton.
We're all in a pretty miserable situation, but we're in it together. And so, you know, rather than making it worse by turning on each other, we make it better by helping each other.
Thornton says she and her neighbors have all been pitching in.
There's just a lot of people out with shovels, helping just random people get their cars unstuck, shovel their driveways, and then, you know, you move on to the next one.
Cassidy Lechner is with the mutual aid group known as the Buffalo Snow Brigade.
You know, we'll ask the folks who are requesting, what do you need? Do you need salting? Do you need de-icing? Do you need your walkway, your porch, your driveway?
All right, now Buffalo has lifted its ban on driving, but Lechner says the Buffalo Mutual Aid Network still needs donations to help people trapped inside.
So we can go and get groceries for people and bring them to their house, because a lot of people haven't been able to go out and get groceries.
And the shoveling continues.
The winter storm last week brought record cold temperatures to much of the United States.
A brutal blast of life-threatening cold from the Canadian border to the Gulf Coast.
Look at this Arctic surge moving.
43 degrees to 10 degrees within just 10 minutes.
Even Atlanta feels like minus 5 degrees.
And that meant record pressure on the electric grid as heaters across the country kicked in to help keep people warm. But despite some strain on the grid, the nation's energy system did not collapse. NPR's Camila Domonoske joins us to discuss. So how big of a challenge was this for the electric grid?
It was pretty significant. And to be clear, what we're talking about here isn't individual poles going down in a storm. That really is significant to the people in the neighborhood who are affected. But the risk with this kind of situation is actually about supplying an entire region, huge parts of the country, just based on how much demand there is at one time. It got really really cold in this storm. And the area that was affected was huge. There were records set for electricity demand in the Southwest, in Texas, in Tennessee. In Texas, they underestimated how much power there would be, which is a really dangerous situation for a grid. And cold weather also affects power production. So this was a real test.
All right, so a lot of strain. How'd the grid do?
Well, it didn't give out. You have to remember there are a bunch of different grids in what we call our grid. Some of them struggled and some of them did better than others. I spoke with Morris Greenberg. He's an analyst with S&P 500 who's been tracking the power sector for more than 25 years. I asked him what grade he would give utilities overall.
Given how broad or large the system was and how low the temperatures got, I would think, you know, a B would be a reasonable grade for this.
There were some outages, some rolling blackouts from systems that couldn't supply enough power. So not A-plus work, but certainly, you know, he says it could be a lot worse. And we all remember what happened in Texas in 2021. That's what a lot worse can look like.
Yes, we do remember that. So, okay, then why weren't things worse? I mean, was it luck or just preparation?
A little bit of both. On the preparation side, there has been winterization, making sure that power plants can keep running when it gets really cold. Things like that happened particularly in Texas. On the luck side, there were a lot of things. This happened right before a holiday weekend. That means demand is on the lower side anyway. It happened early in the winter. That terrible storm in Texas that the grid nearly collapsed, that was in February. Right now, there's still a lot of natural gas in storage because it's early in the season. It's also important that the super cold temperatures sort of moved across the country. So early on, extra power from out east could be sent west. Later on, extra power from the west could be sent east to manage the really intense moments. And there was one more bit of luck that came from the storm itself.
The system was accompanied by pretty strong winds, which meant that wind chill temperatures were lower, but it also meant that in general, wind generation was higher.
So more wind power. That wind might not have felt lucky if you were standing in it, but it did help keep the lights on.
Yeah, I guess we can't count on that with every cold snap, though. What do you think, though, this means for the crystal ball for the electric grid?
I mean, it means that conversations about grid reliability are not going away, especially because, you know, I mentioned all these areas that set new records for demand in the winter. Well, demand is just going to keep going up, especially as the fight against climate change kicks in. People are going to switch to electric vehicles, electric stoves, electric home heating systems. That means less carbon dioxide, but it also means more pressure on the electric grid, including in storms like this, demand switching from natural gas and oil to electricity to run a lot of heat pumps in the winter. So as areas look at future demand going up and up, you know, utilities need to plan ahead and be prepared for extra demand coming in the seasons to come.
And what about the rest of the energy system?
Yeah, we're talking a lot about electricity here, but this storm put pressure on other systems too. I mentioned there are decent supplies of natural gas right now, at least in the parts of the country that were the coldest in this storm. There's plenty of propane too. Some refineries on the coast, on the Gulf Coast, did have to shut down, which has put pressure on supplies of crude oil and gasoline. That's nudging gasoline prices up, but they have been dropping for weeks, so drivers aren't currently feeling too much of a pinch there either.
That's NPR's Camila Domonoske. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on WPR. Good morning and thanks for joining us. I'm Alex Crow. It's 8:19 this Thursday morning. A sculptor in Stevens Point uses snow as his medium. This time of year, you can find him crafting pieces in his front yard. He calls it his snow art zone. That story is coming up in news about 10 minutes away now on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Every Sunday evening, Simply Folk brings you 3 hours of great folk music, from string bands to bluegrass, Celtic, Americana, singer-songwriters, and lots more. For the best in traditional and contemporary folk music, join me, Sheila Shigley, this Sunday from 5 to 8 p.m. here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union and the Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass. Your business or organization can partner in providing the WPR programs that enrich our communities. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
We are in weather today. Freezing rain and light snow are expected in the northern portion of the state. Daytime highs could reach the low 40s in the north and low 50s in the south. Precipitation stops Friday with daytime highs reaching the upper 30s in the north and low 40s in the south. Cloudy for New Year's Eve with rain in the south but dry across the rest of the state. Highs in the mid-30s to low 40s. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Paychex. The Paychex team of professionals and compliance specialists work to help businesses automate all HR functions into one platform so that they can instead focus on their business and their employees. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, using research and evidence to develop solutions that help families and communities create a brighter future for young people. More information is available at aecf.org. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. If you make a resolution to eat more healthy foods in the new year, you may have to think a lot about the food available on the grocery shelves. And we have some history this morning of how that food changed to include a lot more high fructose corn syrup. It was originally invented in the 1950s as a sweetener alternative. Never really got big until Duane Andreas came along. NPR's history podcast, Throughline, has been looking at the way one company took a little-used product and changed the American diet. Here are our hosts, Ramtin Arablouei and Rond Abdelfatah.
You may have never heard of him, but in the 1970s, Duane Andreas was one of the biggest names in the U.S. He was a politically connected CEO of one of the country's biggest agricultural companies, Archer Daniels Midland, or ADM. And by the time he ran across high fructose corn syrup,
it was a product in search of a use.
That's Tom Philpott, a journalist and researcher who's written extensively about American agriculture.
So he's got this product and it's a sweetener and it's really, really sweet. But the problem is that it's too expensive.
He can't sell it at a price that's competitive with regular old cane sugar. So ADM comes up with a scheme. The politically savvy Duane Andreas was going to find a way to turn high fructose corn syrup into cash.
And the President of the United States.
President Ronald Reagan steps up to a podium. It's a crisp fall day, and he's wearing a long tan coat over his usual suit and tie. At the podium, he's dwarfed by an enormous metal bin behind him, a bin filled to the brim with corn.
This is quite a show you're putting on here. And what a pleasure it is for me to be back home in Illinois.
He's speaking to a crowd gathered at a family-run farm in the heart of America's Corn Belt.
Year after year, here in the Midwest, you produce from your rich black earth a bountiful harvest called the American equivalent of the oil riches in the Persian Gulf.
Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter in 1980 and became president in 1981. His presidential campaign was full of patriotism. On the campaign trail, he promised to put profit back in farming and put farmers' interest above the world market. And for Duane Andreas, this rhetoric presented an opportunity.
Jimmy Carter leaves office in 1980. Ronald Reagan takes over. For most people, that's a big contrast. To Duane Andreas, is just a political power player. He's just as tight with Ronald Reagan. And so he goes to work with his lobbying to create a quota on sugar.
A quota on sugar. Basically, Duane Andreas' plan was to promote the idea of putting limits on foreign sugar to protect domestic sugar companies.
There's this history of colonialism and slavery in the Caribbean. And with decolonization in the 20th century, there's still these awful sugar plantations that are able to produce sugar really cheap. And this sugar is coming in and sort of overwhelming the American market.
Sugar producers in states like Florida are organizing, like,
how can we stop this? And they get a key ally in Duane Andreas.
He throws his support behind them. Like, yeah, absolutely. We got to put Florida's sugar farmers first. We got to slow down the importing of foreign sugar.
So what the sugar quota does is, it says only a certain amount of, and a rather small amount of foreign sugar can come into the United States. And once you've hit that quota, imports of sugar are banned. And so that is protecting the domestic sugar industry.
But you might be asking,
why would Duane Andreas do that?
Yeah, why would he help the competition in the sweetener market? It's because he's thinking bigger.
It turns out that because there's this quota in place, it raises the price of sugar because American producers are no longer competing with producers in the Caribbean. So the price of sugar rises fairly steeply, and now suddenly high fructose corn syrup is cheaper than conventional sugar, and it's also a liquid.
A liquid that could go into pretty much any processed food.
And he immediately starts making deals with Coca-Cola and other soft drink manufacturers. You've got to try this stuff. It's cheaper. It's blindingly sweet. You know, you only have to use so much of it. And then slowly other industries start to find uses for it. It goes into baked goods, TV dinner makers. It just, you know, takes this market by storm.
And what about the sugar industry? Did they realize they were being duped?
I think the sugar industry was none too pleased with this development, but they, you know, they made their deal with the devil and they lived with it.
High fructose corn syrup isn't used as much today as it was in the late 1980s. But high fructose corn syrup and other corn-based sweeteners still make up a big portion of the sweetener market. And per capita, Americans are among the biggest consumers of sweeteners in the world. And excessive consumption of these sweeteners is associated with all kinds of health problems, like obesity, diabetes, and high cholesterol. You could argue that they've changed our bodies, our sense of taste, and even the way our societies function.
The genius of the system is that you don't think about any of that when you're enjoying it. We have this system that is in place that we are all part of. You know, we were born into this system where we have all these really unhealthy foods at our disposal for very cheap. But systems don't arise out of nowhere. They're made by people. And I think it's really important for us to, as we look at these systems and we examine them, well, who are the people that were behind them? Who are the architects of these systems?
Tom Philpott speaking with Throughline hosts Rond Abdelfatah and Ramtin Arablouei. You can listen to the whole episode wherever you hear podcasts. This is NPR News.
In three of Alabama's largest cities, the printing presses will stop rolling early next year as local newspapers there go digital only. For those who don't use the internet, it's a big blow.
One of the joys of my life is reading the newspaper.
I'm Sarah McCammon. How newspapers are becoming a thing of the past. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story plus the day's news with Brady Carlson from 4 until 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Good morning. You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. It's 8:29. National news from NPR and state news from Wisconsin Public Radio starts right now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. George Santos says he still expects to be sworn in next Tuesday to serve as a Republican congressman from Long Island. But a prosecutor has opened a probe into lies Santos told during the campaign about his career and his life story. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
George Santos has now acknowledged lying about or embellishing everything from a fictional career on Wall Street to his false claims his family escaped the Holocaust. A Republican district attorney on Long Island issued a statement calling those deceptions, quote, nothing short of stunning. DA Ann Donnelly promised to investigate and says if a crime was committed in this county, we will prosecute it. During interviews on mostly conservative media outlets, Santos has been defiant, downplaying the significance of his lies and promising to serve his full term. Republican leaders in Washington have been mostly silent about the scandal. Santos could be a key vote next week, helping determine who will serve as House Speaker. Brian Mann, NPR News.
A source tells NPR federal prosecutors in the Eastern District of New York are looking into his finances. Air raid sirens sounded across Ukraine today to warn of approaching Russian missiles. Officials say several cities were under attack, including the capital, Kyiv. Russia appears to be targeting infrastructure. Some areas have announced power cuts to minimize potential damage. Moscow repeatedly denies targeting civilians. You're listening to NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. A sculptor in Stevens Point uses snow as his medium. This time of year, you can find him crafting pieces in his front yard. He calls it the Snow Art Zone. Rob Menser has more.
You just can't be afraid of snow, but it's super fragile.
Jeff Schobert is a snow artist. Every winter, he makes about 100 snow sculptures in his yard. He packs the snow into 4-foot-tall blocks and shapes it with a trowel. People follow his work on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. In 2021, his sculpture of a famous photo of Senator Bernie Sanders wearing mittens went viral on social media. Schobert says he loves using a natural material as his medium.
Snow is a particulate of a piece of dirt in the atmosphere that then freezes the moisture and then it lands. So I'm taking a particle of dirt and creating something beautiful out of it.
Schobert says his next piece will be based on the superhero movie Black Adam. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The fight over whether a Department of Natural Resources board member could stay on past his appointed term cost Wisconsin taxpayers about $76,000. The Wisconsin State Journal reports the state made those payments to Fred Prane's attorney between October of last year and February of this year. Prane refused to step down after his term expired, arguing that he did not have to until the Senate confirmed Democratic Governor Tony Evers. The state Senate never voted on that nomination, so Prane said he could stay, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court agreed. Prane, however, recently said that he would step down by Friday, and that could force the Senate to hold a hearing on Governor Evers' nominee. In weather today, light snow expected in northern or northwestern Wisconsin, turning to some rain later on. Highs reaching the low 40s in the north and 50s in the south today. Precipitation stops tomorrow with daytime highs reaching the upper 30s in the north and low 40s in the south. For New Year's Eve Saturday, cloudy with some rain in the south, but dry across the rest of the state. Highs expected to range from the low to mid 30s in the north to the low 40s in the south. For New Year's Day Sunday, mostly dry across Wisconsin, with temperatures hitting the upper 30s in the north and low 40s in the south. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive Nerve Relief. Nervive is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. And from Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Life is so busy during the holiday season that it can be tough to keep up on the news. But people who have tickets to fly on Southwest may have time to hear this next story while they wait for the airline to work out cancellations and delays. NPR's Stacey Vanek-Smith asked how a winter storm hit this airline more than others.
Hillary Chang has been a Southwest Airlines devotee for years. Chang is 29, and she and her boyfriend travel a lot.
I am like a very loyal Southwest customer. I have a Southwest credit card. We actually only fly Southwest.
Chang and her boyfriend were booked on a Southwest flight on Christmas Day from Baltimore to LA with a connection in Houston. They arrived in Houston hours late, only to learn their flight to LA had been canceled. They were told to get their bags and try to rebook.
We hurried a baggage claim, and it's just bags everywhere, probably over 1,000. It's like if you had Legos from a bucket and you were to dump them on the ground, that's what it looked like. So I'm not gonna lie, I was in tears, crying.
Southwest has canceled over 13,000 flights in the last few days, 10 times more than any other airline. Industry analyst Richard Abilafia says it's not surprising airlines struggled given the terrible storm as well as the staffing shortages they've been experiencing. But he says he never expected Southwest to emerge as the cancellation king.
They've got the best reputation for customer service and management agility. They're usually pretty good at responding to crises.
So what went wrong? The problem seems to be twofold. First, Abilafia says most airlines are on a so-called hub and spoke system. They pool resources in certain cities and route most of their flights through there. It is less efficient day-to-day, but it can make it easier to pivot when things go wrong. Southwest uses a so-called point-to-point system, which is leaner and more efficient, but also means resources are more scattered.
Their route system rendered it uniquely vulnerable to a storm-precipitated meltdown.
So did outdated technology. That is what the president of the Southwest Flight Attendants Union, Lynn Montgomery, told NPR.
The way that they have to notify their flight crews is a manual process. You actually have to talk to a crew scheduler.
Longtime Southwest loyalist Hillary Chang says that systems meltdown was on full display at the Houston airport on Christmas.
There were hundreds of people standing in line. It wrapped all the way around the building. You have like crying children and moms that are breastfeeding. And there are people who are elderly, like really bundled up because Houston just happened to be freezing on Christmas.
Chang and her boyfriend quickly realized they would have to fend for themselves. They rented a car and drove the 21 hours back to Los Angeles. Chang doesn't expect to get her suitcase back ever, which is really upsetting. Chang's boyfriend just proposed and the ring is on her finger, but the ring box was in her suitcase and she was hoping to save it as a keepsake. Chang says all of this has really shaken her years-long loyalty to Southwest.
I'm open to dating a new airline.
Social media is full of former Southwest loyalists saying they are done with the carrier. Meanwhile, Southwest CEO released a statement saying they're working to understand what went so wrong and are, quote, apologizing daily to staff and customers. Stacey Vanek-Smith, NPR News.
President Biden made a lot of foreign policy moves during his first year in office, and of them, the most prominent was the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. During Biden's second year, very different events dominated the news, and administration officials insist that hard first year set the stage for the second. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Dear Tony, welcome back to NATO headquarters.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken spent a lot of time this year with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
In fact, I'm going to ask you if there are apartments available at NATO headquarters because we're here so much that we probably need one.
The war in Ukraine has given NATO a new sense of purpose after a chaotic end to its mission in Afghanistan last year. Secretary of State Blinken puts it this way.
If we were still in Afghanistan, it would have, I think, made much more complicated the support that we've been able to give and that others have been able to give Ukraine to resist and push back against the Russian aggression.
Russia's war in Ukraine also gave the Biden administration a chance to show the world they are a competent team, says Aaron David Miller of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
In a way, Putin offered Joe Biden a moment of real competence, credibility, and even greatness in American foreign policy. After all, Russia and Ukraine was probably the most consequential event in Europe since the end of the Second World War.
Miller says that the Ukrainian president's dramatic visit to Washington was designed to keep Congress and U.S. allies on board with the U.S. approach, that is, to help Ukraine degrade Russia's military without getting into a direct conflict with Moscow.
It's not perfect, but it was as high a mark, I think, as anybody could have expected. And in the wake of Afghanistan, I think it completely reversed the image that America would never lead again.
Corey Shockey of the American Enterprise Institute agrees, but she says the Biden administration is going to have to get Europe to start spending more in Ukraine.
If that's not forthcoming, the Secretary of State ought to be preparing Americans for that, and he ought to be working to get Europeans to more equitably share the burden with the United States, especially in the reconstruction phase, and I don't see that work going on.
Blinken talks a lot about working together with allies on challenges from Russia to China.
We're in a fundamentally stronger position to address the issues that actually affect the lives of the American people when we do so alongside the many countries that share our fundamental interests and values.
But when it comes to China, that may not be enough, according to a former Assistant Secretary of State for Asia, Susan Thornton, now at Yale Law School.
It seems like most of the operation is aimed at sort of working with other countries against China rather than working with China. And I personally just think that we can't accomplish our goals in foreign policy if we're not working with China.
She says the U.S. needs to work with China on the big global issues, nonproliferation, health, and climate change. Blinken plans a trip there early next year, and Thornton says he has his work cut out.
We would have to sort of start to build back some kind of constructive conversation after 3 years of a pandemic where I basically had no contact, and you know, several years before that where the relationship was in free fall.
Thornton says it doesn't help that this administration talks about a world divided into autocracies and democracies. Corey Shockey of AEI puts that in her debit column too, as she reflects on Biden's foreign policy this year.
Grandstanding on putting human rights at the center of U.S. foreign policy without follow through with Saudi Arabia or Egypt, and this pointless statement about support for women and girls in Afghanistan is heartbreaking in its emptiness.
Blinken says a lot of countries are joining the U.S. in pressuring the Taliban to give women and girls access to education. So far, international condemnation hasn't had much of an impact on Afghanistan's rulers. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:42 this Thursday morning. And don't forget, you can make WPR a part of your holiday plans this year. We'll bring you some great holiday specials on New Year's Day. That includes New Year's 2023 Concert from Vienna, the popular annual New Year's Day concert starting at 10 o'clock in the morning on New Year's Day. Learn more about all of our specials at WPR.org/holidays.
Hanukkah lights, Christmas at Luther College, and Beethoven's Missa Solemnis on Wisconsin Classical January 1st. Enjoy these festive programs now through the new year on Wisconsin Public Radio. Find a complete schedule of holiday programs at WPR.org/holidays.
Support for WPR comes from the Gunderson Life Celebration Centers and Wild Birds Unlimited. Businesses play an important role in our communities and in funding quality news, talk, and music on WPR. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support for WGTD comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. ADRC provides free memory screen Mondays for those concerned about memory changes. Call to schedule an appointment. The number is 262-605-6646.
Thanks for joining us. At 8:44, here's a look at what's happening in the news today. Multiple regions of Ukraine, including its capital of Kyiv, facing a massive Russian missile attack this morning, the biggest wave of strikes in weeks, targeting power stations and other critical infrastructure during freezing weather. A Republican district attorney in New York has opened a probe into Representative-elect George Santos, who has admitted to misleading the public about much of his official biography. Another day of cancellations at Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport. 10 Southwest Airlines flights have been canceled already so far today. That makes it 60 Southwest flights in Milwaukee canceled in just the past 3 days. Today, we're expecting some light snow or rain in the northern portion of the state with warmer temperatures throughout. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, providing an online evaluation and the tools to help people lead healthier lives through behavior change. More information at Noom, NOOM.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Colorado's cannabis industry had a hard year. Sales boomed during the pandemic to more than $2 billion statewide, but a post-pandemic decline has seen prices drop by more than 20%. Ben Marcus of Colorado Public Radio reports on how some growers are coping.
Just off the freeway in North Denver, among shabby-looking warehouses, the slight smell of marijuana on the streets signals that this is the city's de facto marijuana farmland. It's freezing and dry outside, but inside one of these warehouses, it feels tropical, warm and bright and humid, filled with tall green plants. This operation is owned by Matt Huron of Good Chemistry Nurseries.
You're looking at my 401k right now.
It is not cheap to build one of these. But much to his chagrin, Huron is now competing with a bunch of new grows. It all started when the pandemic lockdowns led to a boom in demand. For the first time, legal cannabis sales hit $2 billion in Colorado in 2020. Investment rushed into every level of the industry, but especially grows.
Everyone saw the lines around the corner. Cannabis is pandemic-proof, right? Well, you know, it takes a good year and a half to build one of these things.
But by the time they opened, vaccines had become widespread. Pot lost some of its appeal, as people weren't just sitting at home streaming Netflix anymore. Huron and the other Denver growers saw what was happening, and they pulled back production. But at the same time, counties all over Colorado had already approved new grows, like out in rural Crowley County, where Roy Elliott is a county commissioner.
It's still a pretty sore subject in the county.
Colorado lets governments ban marijuana businesses, and like most rural counties, Crowley initially didn't allow grow houses.
Being mostly right-leaning county, a lot of people aren't too fond of marijuana grows.
But it's only got 6,000 residents, half of whom are inmates at the local private prison. In 2016, Crowley okayed pot farms. But nothing materialized until the pandemic. And almost overnight, it became the eighth largest producing county in Colorado.
It hit that boom after COVID, and I think too many people got into it.
Now, Elliott says some of those grows are closing permanently, and many are still sitting on a lot of marijuana that hasn't hit the market yet, which means the supply glut will last into 2023. Christopher Steffen is a real estate broker who specializes in cannabis. He says that's bad because consumer demand never bounced back.
You know, Black Friday used to be a big day for us, and it hit with a thud.
Marijuana tax collections have fallen by more than $90 million this year. It funds everything from school construction to addiction treatment. Steffen says during the pandemic, businesses were expanding rapidly, courted by big money investors. Now, they're unraveling.
And now you're meeting with lawyers all day and you're fighting your partners and your best friends.
Back in Denver at Matt Huron's Grow Warehouse, he says marijuana has become like the hyper-competitive restaurant industry, where some will do well.
And then there's a gazillion other guys that open up a restaurant and they're out of business in a year. And that's really what the cannabis industry is now.
And just like a restaurant, Huron hopes to distinguish his Good Chemistry stores by focusing on quality, on proprietary marijuana he spent years cultivating, appealing to the discerning customer. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. It's 8:49. News headlines are coming up in about 11 minutes. After that, it'll be Morning Classics. Stephanie Elkins, the host, will bring you Morning Classics. Again, that's going to be starting after the news at 9 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's New Year's Day from Vienna 2023. Franz Welser-Müst conducts the Vienna Philharmonic in the annual celebration. I'm Lisa Mullins. Join me for New Year's Day from Vienna from NPR Music.
Sunday at 10 a.m. on WGTD.
Brought to you by WPR and NAMI Wisconsin, the state organization of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Thanks for joining us for Morning Edition on WPR. In sports, the Bucks fell to the Bulls 119-113 last night. The Badgers women's basketball team will be taking on Illinois. That's a home game tonight. It starts at 6:30. The nationally ranked Badgers men's basketball team will be playing Western Michigan on Friday. In the NFL tonight, Thursday night football, the Tennessee Titans play the Dallas Cowboys. The Green Bay Packers will take on the Vikings later on this weekend. In weather today, freezing rain and light snow expected in the northern portion of the state to start. Daytime highs could reach the low 40s in the north and low 50s in the south. Precipitation stops Friday, with daytime highs reaching the upper 30s in the north and low 40s in the south. Cloudy with rain in the south, but dry across the rest of the state for New Year's Eve on Saturday. Highs in the low to mid 30s in the north and low 40s in the south. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. One of the last big album releases of 2022 came from the hip-hop singer and songwriter SZA. It's called SOS, and it shot straight to number one. This week, we've been asking people about the lyrics that moved them this past year, and the writer Kiana Fitzgerald found one on the SZA record.
The lyric that stuck with me the most comes from Blind.
Eating everything to get no fasting. I don't care how much you knew me in the past tense. I ain't no Julia Stiles, this ain't no last dance. Way past it. Wait.
The lyric is, it's so embarrassing. All of the things I need living inside of me, I can't see it.
It's so embarrassing. All of the things I need living inside of me, I can't see it. It's so embarrassing.
The relatability of this lyric really struck a chord with me, as well as many, many other listeners. And some of us are more readily vocal about why we relate to it, and other people will never admit to it. It's SZA basically saying, you want to be with me to a potential partner or a former partner, but I need to figure this out for myself. I need to figure out how to love myself without all these obstacles in the way that you're tossing in my direction.
I don't want righteousness, I hurt too much, I lost too much, I lost too much, I hit my clutch and vroom, third day pop out the tomb.
You know, it's something that anybody can relate to. Just feelings of inadequacy, feelings of jealousy or trust issues or anything that you might have with someone that you're willing to deal with romantically. You know, we've all, or many of us, I should say, have been through relationships, situationships, dysfunctional, functioning, whatever. And there's always some kind of tug and pull when it comes to love. So this is something that I feel many people can relate to, and that's why it's performing as well as it is.
I can't see, I'm blind.
The song is by SZA. It's called Blind. Kiana Fitzgerald is a frequent contributor to NPR Music and the Pop Culture Happy Hour. Next, we have some music from Detroit, Motown. You know, the Supremes, the Temptations, Smokey Robinson, that sort of thing. It totally changed the landscape of American music and also changed roller skating. Detroit's black skaters were inspired by the hits coming from Motown Records, a tempo and rhythm that helped to create what is known as the Detroit style. NPR's Nina Rao reports.
I'm standing right on the edge of the roller skating rink at Northland Roller Rink in Detroit, Michigan. It's skate jam night, and the theme is throwback. This means skate night with R&B, disco, and soul music playing for everyone to jam to.
Detroit style is what you see.
That 61-year-old Angie McClendon, she's been skating since she was 5, so she knows what makes the Detroit style unique.
We just don't skate willy-lilly. There's certain things we do, half turns, reverses.
Like the hatch, where 3 skaters hold hands and turn their bodies right to left as they're moving. The Detroit style can also be done while the rest of the body is mostly still, with the help of toe stops, which are rubber balls on the bottom of the skates. This uniqueness can be traced back to the early days of Motown.
Standing still allows you to put it on a stage.
Tasha Klusman is the historian behind the National African American Roller Skating Archive.
With Motown, they were learning to smile and how to carry an audience and how to present themselves. Roller skating was just another vehicle to do it.
The origins of the Great Migration influenced this move. Klusman says many Black families left the South between 1910 to 1970 due to lynching and other crimes. In Detroit, companies like Ford provided a way for people to make money, buy houses, cars, and own businesses, like the Rollercade Rink.
And we are reporting live from Rollercade for the 67th anniversary skate party.
Founders Johnny and Leroy Folks migrated from Alabama to Detroit and fell in love with roller skating after several summer trips to Idlewild. Kyle Black is Johnny and Leroy's grandson.
There was only one skating rink in the neighborhood, and they only allowed Black people one day out of the week, and they wanted to skate more frequently.
Black says that motivated his grandparents to open a space for their children and community to roller skate in 1955. Nearly 70 years later, the rink is still standing with a new location in downtown and increased popularity.
During the pandemic, roller skating was one of the few outlets that people had that was safe, which led to an immediate spike in skate sales and participation.
In fact, skyrocketing roller skate sales led to a shortage of them worldwide in 2020 and 2021. Nolan Edwards, founder of the Detroit Skating Company and collective Motown Roller Club, says social media played a huge role in this major skating resurgence.
During the COVID timeframe, one of our videos got about 500,000 views on it. That one that we put out on TikTok and Instagram attained like a big majority of the following for us.
Edwards says videos that will gain 50 to 60 likes every month increased to thousands on the company's TikTok during the pandemic.
I don't think people realize how powerful TikTok is. It was thanks to the internet. People just fell in love with roller skating and it just absolutely blew up.
Edwards started posting instructional skate videos on social media, which helped Motown Roller Club take off. And now, it hosts weekly skate classes and sessions across Detroit, including Northland Roller Rink. 19-year-old Elijah Smith is skating across the rink for Skate Jam Night. He's recording some of the skaters on his phone to post on social media. What he loves most about roller skating is how he can add new things to the Detroit style. The same moves used 50 years ago are still being used today.
So it's not a set thing that you have to do every time. So when you're coming out on the floor, it's just always something brand new every single time.
Ensuring this tradition stays alive as a new generation takes over. For NPR News, I'm Naina Rao.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Alex Crow. You've been listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. 1 minute before 9 o'clock, news and then Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins next.
Support for WPR comes from Commonweal Theater and TDS Custom Construction.
Your business or organization can partner in providing the WPR programs that enrich our communities. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
It's New Year's Day from Vienna 2023. Franz Welser Müst conducts the Vienna Philharmonic in the annual celebration. I'm Lisa Mullins. Join me for New Year's Day from Vienna from NPR Music.
Sunday at 10 a.m. on WGTD. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.